was inaugurated. Dulles as CIA director. They called him Ali, one of the Sulzberger families, in one letter. They would get together, you know, every year. Dulles would hold these media sort of drink fests for New Year's. And these were, you know, top reporters, top editors would get together with the CIA guys and rub elbows and get a little drunk. And, you know, when Alan Dulles didn't want a reporter because he felt he was being overly aggressive, covering, say, Guatemala, Sidney Grusin, the reporter, in the run-up to the coup there in 1954, he made a call to the New York Times and had him removed. That was because of his relationship with Sulzberger, the publisher. So that was the kind of pull that Alan Dulles had.
How did that work?
Well, they just took him out. They removed Grusin. They transferred him, I think, to Mexico at that point.
David Talbot on his new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. To see parts 1 and 3, you can go to democracynow.org. We have a job opening at Democracy Now. We're hiring a director of development to lead our fundraising efforts. You can find out more at democracynow.org. Send your resume in. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guster, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, and Pedro Rodriguez. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Vesta Gadars, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Meadows, and Trina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the city of Milwaukee considers adopting a $15 an hour minimum wage for all city workers.
The city of Albany says its contractors accidentally released 3,000 gallons of raw sewage into the Willamette River.
And the Obama administration has stopped the sale of new oil drilling leases in the Arctic for 2016 and 2017.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 19th, 2015. I'm Callie.
And I'm Ken Jones. City workers and community supporters from Milwaukee and Portland will pack the Milwaukee City Council chambers tomorrow. They'll be voicing support for a resolution introduced by Mayor Mark Gamba to raise the minimum wage for all city workers and full-time contract workers in the city of Milwaukee. For more information, KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with Justin Norton Kurtzen with the 15 Now Coalition.
Justin, could you tell us about the resolution that's going to be introduced tomorrow at the Milwaukee City Council?
So it's similar to what the city of Portland did back in February. The resolution will be a $15 minimum wage for all city workers in the city of Milwaukee. That includes full-time, part-time, seasonals, interns. And then it will also provide for a $15 minimum wage for full-time contract workers people who work for companies that contract with the city and do, you know, janitorial services and security services on city property.
Are these unionized workers?
A lot of the contract workers, no, they're not. Most of the full-time and some of the part-time city workers are represented by AFSCME, and so they are union workers. And actually, a number of the city workers already make 15. So in terms of city workers, it's more going to benefit the seasonals and the interns who aren't already up at that level of pay.
And what's been the impact of the $15 an hour minimum wage in Seattle, where it passed last year and is slowly being implemented?
Yeah, so it's being implemented. It's not up to 15 yet, but they have had increases. I believe they're up to around $10 or $11 an hour at the moment. depending on the size of the business. And it's actually, everything is going great up in Seattle. Since they've started phasing in the 15 minimum wage, unemployment has dropped in the city and in the larger, in King County in general. And actually over the last few months, thousands of restaurant jobs have been added in the city of Seattle. In fact, in a one-month period in August, they had more restaurant jobs added than in any other month in the city's history, you know, as long as they've been tracking the statistics. You know, the doomsday scenarios definitely are not coming to pass in Seattle.
There was an article that came out in a right-wing publication that was widely spread around several months ago claiming that businesses were closing in Seattle due to the $15 an hour minimum wage, and I believe that was largely discredited.
Yeah, the Seattle Times actually did an investigative piece looking into that claim. And what they found with the restaurant owners that they actually went out and talked to was that none of them were closing because of the minimum wage. A lot of them really weren't even closing at all. They were shutting down one location and moving their store to what they considered to be a better location in the city. So it was really a case of just, you know, some journalists deciding that, oh, well, you know, these restaurants are closing, and so it must be because of the minimum wage, without really looking into why the stores were closing or what the situation was or even talking with the owners.
What do you see as the impact that this will have on workers in the city of Milwaukee when the resolution is passed?
Oh, it's going to help make working people in Milwaukee, these city workers and contract workers, more self-sufficient, right? I mean, the city of Milwaukee's right next to Portland here, and the cost of living isn't any different. Rent is high there. Food is expensive. Childcare and transportation are expensive. And you know, a $15 minimum wage is a significant increase, and it's going to help these people and their families be able to afford the basics without having to rely on so much government assistance.
What's the status of the statewide campaign to get a $15 an hour minimum wage across the state of Oregon?
Yeah, we have a ballot measure initiative. It's an initiative petition 41, and we are currently gathering signatures pretty much every day. We're out on the streets collecting signatures. We have to collect 88,000 valid signatures by July 1st to get it on the ballot, and we're really confident that we're not only going to get it on the ballot, but we're going to win. And this is an issue that people in Oregon really care about. It's already polling well over 50% or over, and we're still a whole year out from the election. So with all the big victories that are happening for 15 here in Oregon and across the country all the time, we're extremely confident that when it comes to November, we're going to have the votes to get it passed.
And are you looking for help, volunteers to help collect signatures and that kind of thing?
Yeah, we need lots of volunteers. We need as much help as we can get. And people can go actually to our coalition website, or it's oregoniansfor15.org. And you can send us a message through there, and we can get you set up with days and times when you can come out and help.
And that's Oregonians for 15. Is that the number 15?
Yeah, the number 15 and F-O-R spelled out for.
So Oregonians, F-O-R, and then the number 15.org, Oregonians for 15.org. Again, I've been speaking with Justin Norton Kurtzen. He is with 15 Now PDX and is part of a group that will be introducing a resolution. The mayor of Milwaukee will be introducing the resolution tomorrow at the city council meeting there in the city of Milwaukee. And supporters of the $15 an hour minimum wage will be coming up and having a show of support at the city council meeting tomorrow. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The Portland City Council has delayed this week's planned hearing on a funding proposal for affordable housing until October 28th. The proposal calls for an increase in public funding for affordable housing by as much as $91 million over the next 10 years. Commissioner Dan Saltzman, who oversees Portland's Housing Bureau, called for the delay because city leaders still haven't been able to reach agreement on funding. At issue is the amount of money the city spends on affordable housing within urban renewal districts. Portland's current policy calls for a minimum of 30% within all districts. Last August, a housing advisory group recommended increasing that share to 50%. However, Portland's mayor and commissioners have been unable to agree. Commissioner Saltzman and Nick Fish support a big increase in affordable housing funding, while Mayor Charlie Hales and Commissioners Steve Novick and Amanda Fritz express reservations. Increasing funding for affordable housing would result in less urban renewal money for redevelopment projects, parks, and transportation projects.
The city of Albany says its contractors accidentally released 3,000 gallons of raw sewage into the Willamette River downstream of Bowman Park. The spill happened last Wednesday and was announced by the city on Friday. Workers who were cleaning and doing maintenance on the sewer system dislodged plugs and old sewer lines, releasing sewage into the river for about 2 to 3 hours. Kristen Preston, the city wastewater superintendent, said crews immediately plugged up the old lines. Signs have been posted to warn the public of potential hazards if they come in contact with the water. The city says the river should flush out the bacteria within a few days.
Demolition has begun on the iconic Gasco building, located just east of the St. John's Bridge. Despite protests from local activists, the building's owner, Northwest Natural Gas, has declared the building to be structurally unsafe and contaminated with asbestos and lead. The 102-year-old building has sat empty for the last 57 years. The demolition should be completed by Halloween.
Portland police today released the identity of the man shot and killed Sunday in the parking lot of a downtown nightclub. Dion Anthony Matthews Jr., a 23-year-old resident of Northeast Portland, died of a gunshot wound behind Dante's, located near West Burnside and 3rd Avenue. The shooting occurred at 11:15 p.m. yesterday night, and detectives are asking for the public's help to help identify the suspect. Anyone with information on Matthews' death is asked to contact the Portland police detectives in charge of the case at 503-823-0457 or 503-823-0416.
Researchers at Oregon Health and Science University say that clinical trials for new Alzheimer's disease treatments can be made more efficient and accurate with the use of technology to track patients' behaviors. The current standard for assessment is annual memory tests, requiring that about 2,000 people be followed around for 4 years to determine whether potential therapy or medication works. Dr. Jeff Kay, director of OHSU's Layton Center for Aging and Alzheimer's Disease, says the reason so many people are needed for the studies is because the test isn't the most precise way to gather accurate data. With the help of gadgets that rely on motion sensors and other tools to track the daily activities of an Alzheimer's patient, the number of participants in these studies would be reduced. No cameras are used in this method.
A new report from the American Academy of Pediatrics found that prenatal exposure to alcohol is the leading preventable cause of birth defects as well as intellectual and developmental disabilities in children. The paper, published in the November 2015 issue of Pediatrics, stresses that there is no safe amount of alcohol that can be consumed during any trimester of pregnancy. The American Academy of Pediatrics emphasizes that all forms of alcohol, beer, wine, distilled spirits, pose similar risks. The report, co-authored by the AAP Committee on Substance Abuse, also stresses that alcohol-related birth defects and developmental disabilities are completely preventable if pregnant women abstain from alcohol.
A federal judge today overruled Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal's order to block Medicaid funding for Planned Parenthood. U.S. District Judge John DeGrevilles signed an order in Baton Rouge to continue providing the funding to Planned Parenthood for 14 more days while the legal battle continues. Governor Jindal, who is also running for the Republican presidential nomination, began the defunding effort after videos were released by the anti-abortion group Center for Medical Progress. Planned Parenthood, which does not currently provide abortions in Louisiana, challenged the state's right to end funding for cancer screenings, gynecology exams, and other health services. Attorneys for Planned Parenthood Gulf Coast argued Jindal's order to cut funding is politically motivated. Judge DeGrevilles wrote in his ruling that, quote, "Uncontradicted evidence in the record at this time is that Planned Parenthood does not reform abortions in Louisiana, is not involved in the sale of fetal tissue, and none of the conduct in question occurred at Planned Parenthood's two Louisiana facilities." The judge said that it appears likely Planned Parenthood will be able to prove the cut to funding was ordered for reasons unrelated to the organization's competence. According to Planned Parenthood, 5,200 low-income Medicaid patients obtain services through the two Louisiana clinics.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Jim Robison about the Portland Harbor Community Action Group, which today submitted its report to the Environmental Protection Agency about the progress of the cleanup of the Willamette River Superfund site. The Lower Willamette was declared a Superfund site in desperate need of cleanup 15 years ago. Hundreds of millions of dollars and 15 years later, very little progress has been made. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6. Of the Working Class, by the Working Class, and for the Working Class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline. Karen James interviews criminal defense attorney Jesse William Barton about maximizing the chances of obtaining true Measure 11 reform. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, 30% chance of showers before 11 p.m., mostly cloudy, with a low around 53. Tomorrow, patchy drizzle with areas of fog before 11 a.m., otherwise mostly cloudy through mid-morning, then gradual clearing with a high near 67. Today in history, in 1781, Major General Lord Charles Cornwallis surrendered to George Washington and the Count de Rochambeau at Yorktown, Virginia, effectively ending the American Revolutionary War. And in 1949, the People's Republic of China was formally proclaimed. The quote of the day is from Isaiah Berlin, who wrote, "Injustice, poverty, slavery, ignorance, these may be cured by reform or revolution, but men do not live only by fighting evils. They live by positive goals, individual and collective, a vast variety of them, seldom predictable, at times incompatible."
It's 5:16, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If it was under the big top, it would be a hilarious clown show with pratfalls, wild posturing, tumbling, juggling, and a cacophony of comic chaos. But alas, it's under the Capitol Dome, so it's just the Republican Congressional Caucus bumbling, stumbling, and crashing into each other in clownish acts of ideological zaniness, political incoherence, and pathetic ineptitude. The present bedlam on the Hill was prompted by Speaker John Boehner abruptly deciding to zippity-doo-dah out of office, having finally given up on corralling his caucus of clowns. Sadly, his withdrawal has only intensified the buffoonery, generating a slapstick intramural contest over which group of far-out right-wingers will replace him. Boehner's contingent of anti-government corporate-hugging extremists want one of their own, while assorted groupings of even fringier, farther-out packs of Mad Dog Tea Party Republicans want someone who'll howl at the moon and literally shut down the government. For a moment, Representative Paul Ryan appeared to be the consensus pick, except for two problems. One, he doesn't really want the thankless task of clown herding. And two, even though he's an Ayn Rand-worshipping, coke-hugging, laissez-fairyland ideologue dedicated to killing everything from Social Security to Obamacare, Ryan is just not right-wing enough for the howlers. He's still considering whether to run for the job, but even if he does and wins, the spectacle will continue. This is Jim Hightower saying, here's the irony in Ryan's predicament. He created his own mess. He was chief architect of the 2010 Republican scheme to take over Congress by recruiting and electing the mad dogs who are now biting him on the butt and turning the U.S. House of Representatives into the House of Ridiculousness. As Representative Peter King put it, we look absolutely crazy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. If Joe Biden takes the presidential plunge, the International Association of Firefighters may have his back. IAF President Harold Schaeferger has reportedly spoken with the vice president and may endorse him should Biden get into the race. Schaeferger isn't commenting publicly on what was said in the phone call. The Firefighters Union has told the Clinton campaign that it has decided, at least for now, not to endorse Clinton. California State University faculty are voting on whether to authorize a system-wide strike. If they authorize one, it gives union leaders authority to strike if CSU administrators and faculty are unable to reach an agreement after the fact-finding stage. Monica Lopez has more from Cal Poly Pomona.
It's the height of Cal Poly's morning commute. A group of demonstrators are calling attention to the breakdown in negotiations over faculty salaries and a strike authorization vote that's scheduled to run October 19th through the 28th. California Faculty Association is asking for a 5% salary increase for librarians, coaches, counselors, and full and part-time faculty. They're also seeking a 2.65% service increase for eligible employees. The CSU administration's offer is a 2% raise. Dorothy Wills is a professor of anthropology at Cal Poly Pomona.
If you're an adjunct professor or you've been teaching here for a long time and your wages have stagnated for 10 or more years, getting a 1-point-something raise doesn't look very good. We haven't had a cost of living raise. Our last decent contract was 2006, and so we said, no thanks.
The process is now in the fact-finding stage, where a third party will hear from administration and faculty representatives to recommend a possible settlement. After that, the CSU can make its last, best, and final offer. Monica Lopez, Workers Independent News, Cal Poly Pomona.
Now here's Mitch Lawrence with Wynn's Sports Minute.
Baseball is front and center these days with one of the epic playoff matchups going on between the New York Mets and Chicago Cubs. Nobody ever thought we'd see the Mets playing the Cubs in the National League Championship Series, but here they are, with the winner advancing to the World Series. This was supposed to be a year of growth for the Cubs with all their promising rookies and Joe Maddon in his first season managing the team, but they're one step away from the World Series, which any long-suffering Cub fan will tell you hasn't happened since 1945, and they haven't won the series since 1908. The man who put the team together and brought in Maddon is Theo Epstein. If his name sounds familiar, it's because he was at the helm of the Boston Red Sox as their general manager in 2004 when they broke their 85-year championship drought by winning their first World Series since 1918. Epstein has been on the job in Chicago as the president of baseball operations for only four seasons, but you can just imagine what will happen if the Cubs defeat the Mets and go on to win the whole thing. Theo Epstein will have written himself a ticket to Cooperstown in the Baseball Hall of Fame by the ripe old age of 41. Not too bad, you've got to admit.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A new review of scientific literature has found that the vast majority of studies conclude that fracking worsens air quality, contaminates water sources, and harms public health. More than 15 million Americans live within a mile of a fracking site that has been drilled in the past decade and a half. Numerous studies in the past decade have indicated that natural gas drilling and fracking are inherently dangerous. Fracking poses threats to the air and water and to residents living close by, according to the report's authors. The new compendium of fracking research was published this week by Concerned Health Professionals of New York and Physicians for Social Responsibility. It includes reviews of more than 500 fracking-related studies. The overwhelming consensus among these studies is that there is no way that fracking can be carried out in a way that protects human and environmental health.
The Obama administration has announced that it has stopped the sale of new oil drilling leases in the Arctic for 2016 and 2017. This comes on the heels of Shell's announcement that they're giving up exploration efforts in the Arctic for the time being. Shell said its decision was due to low oil prices. The administration said its decision was based on Shell's move as well as oil prices. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Daphne Wysham, director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for Sustainable Economy, to learn more and to find out about the impact of protests on those decisions.
Well, first of all, it's great news, and we owe a huge shout-out to all of the kayaktivists and the supporters that came out at the St. John's Bridge and helped draw attention to the Seneca, that was the Shell's Arctic icebreaker that was preparing to leave to allow Shell to drill in the Arctic. Although the Obama administration claims that the reason for canceling this, these two Arctic leases held by Statoil and Shell is purely due to economics and the fact that Shell, that their attempts to find oil had come up dry, we know very well that part of the factors that he was weighing in his mind, among the factors, was the large and growing protests that we helped contribute to, people here in Portland as well up in Seattle and all around the world, where people were saying enough. we need to leave 80% of the proven reserves in the ground. And Arctic oil is yet to be proven. It could be vast, but it needs to stay there if we're to avoid very dangerous climate change. We're already on track to potentially dangerous climate change, and we really need to ramp down our oil and gas and coal and tar sands production. So it seems to be that he's at least, you know, put it off for the next president, whoever he or she may be, to determine whether or not it makes sense to keep the Arctic off limits permanently. And ideally, because the U.S. does chair the Arctic Council this year, our hope is that they can use their leadership to push other Arctic countries to also declare the Arctic off limits to drilling.
You mentioned the next administration. The Interior Secretary appeared to leave the door open for later leases. There's a draft proposal which lists a single lease in the Beaufort Sea for 2020 and one in the Chukchi Sea for 2022. What chances do you think environmentalists will have of stopping those?
Well, I think if we have a Democrat in the White House, we've heard from the two leading contenders, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, that they both think it's unwise to drill in the Arctic. So I think there's a good chance that if either one of them gets elected or the other Democratic contenders, I would imagine that the Arctic would stay off limits. Republicans, you know, are known for very close ties with the oil industry. So all bets are off if we have a Republican in the White House.
Just again, if you could speak for another moment about the effectiveness of protests. Obviously, Shell claims the decisions based on economics, the price of oil and all that, not enough to justify the added expense. Safe to say that one of those added expense is the dealing with the PR?
Well, here's the reason why their claim is not genuine, the claim that it's all about the price of oil. First of all, the price of oil was the same going into their plans to drill in the Arctic as it was when they decided it was too low. So nothing has changed. The other factor is that the oil would not actually come to market for maybe 10 or 15 years if they were to discover the oil in the Arctic. So this notion that somehow the price of oil today is having is the deciding factor in all of this, I think, is a bit disingenuous. And yes, absolutely, the power of protest, I think, cannot be understated. We've created a whole new word, kayaktivist. This word was not part of our lexicon until very recently. We've seen the profile of this issue raised globally as a result of the protests that took place here in Portland, Oregon. And it's clear that played into the what they call uncertainty in the regulatory environment up in the Arctic, which essentially is code for increasing pressure on politicians to take stronger measures, to put in place stronger measures to restrict oil and gas leasing in the Arctic, as they should. But it just goes to show the power of the people is, despite all of the money on the other side, the power of the people remains very powerful.
Daphne, any closing thoughts, and where would people go to find out more about some of your work?
Well, I do want to point out that all this is a good and perhaps only temporary victory. We also need to get the Obama administration to declare public lands off limits for federal leasing of fossil fuels. The Obama administration has that power, and a recent report found that if we were to begin to open up even more public lands for fossil fuel leasing, we would vastly surpass our ability to keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius. or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's the next phase of this campaign, of the so-called Keep It in the Ground campaign, is to get the Obama administration to stop leasing public lands for fossil fuels, to keep the coal, especially the coal, in the ground, but also the oil and gas and tar sands. And for more information on the Center for Sustainable Economy, you can go to sustainable-economy.org. We're a part of the Climate Action Coalition here in Portland, and that website is climate-action-coalition.org.
I've been speaking with Daphne Weisham, Director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for Sustainable Economy. Daphne, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
A long smoldering underground fire at a dump outside of St. Louis is now less than 1,000 feet from burning into highly radioactive waste left over from the 1940s atomic weapons production program. The unlined dump, located less than 20 miles from downtown St. Louis, is divided into several sectors, two of which contain radioactive waste generated by the Manhattan Project during uranium processing that built the first atomic bombs. In 2010, an underground fire began in another sector of the landfill, which dump operators have been unable to put out. As the fire advances towards the area containing the nuclear waste, authorities are worried that if the fire burns the waste, it would send a radioactive plume of smoke over the region. Amid public complaints that the smoke from the dump fire was causing breathing problems and burning citizens' eyes, in 2013 the Missouri Department of Natural Resources tested the air and found it to contain both benzene and hydrogen sulfide. Last week it was revealed that local government officials had quietly adopted an emergency plan, calling for the public to either shelter in place or evacuate the region in the event the fire reaches the radioactive materials. Authorities believe that short of the fire being extinguished, it could reach the radioactive area within the next 3 to 6 months.
The personal email account of CIA Director John Brennan has reportedly been hacked by a pair of high school students. The account was not Brennan's government email. Rather, it was an account with a private service, America Online. The New York Post, which broke the story, claims that one of the hackers got in touch with them and bragged that he used social engineering to get information about Brennan from his phone company, then convinced AOL to reset the account's password. Social engineering simply refers to tricking and manipulating people into breaching security, so no high-tech gimmicks or gadgets were involved. Brennan reportedly used the private account for some government business. The hackers claim to have obtained a spreadsheet from the account, which contains the personal information of more than a dozen top U.S. intelligence officials, including their Social Security numbers. The account also contained a letter discussing the use of harsh interrogation techniques on people accused of being involved with terrorism. After the news broke, Brennan's hacked AOL account was suspended, according to a screenshot from AOL that was posted to a Twitter account supposedly belonging to the hacker.
If you're planning to give one of your loved ones the gift of a drone this December, you may have to register it with the government. The U.S. Department of Transportation and the Federal Aviation Administration today announced plans to create regulations and a drone registry. The agencies are setting up a task force to examine the issues and develop recommendations for creation of the registry. The task force will be composed of 25 to 30 people, representing various stakeholder groups, including manufacturers, aviation-related organizations, and the Consumer Electronics Association. The task force will have until November 20th to come up with recommendations so that a registration process can be in place by Christmas.
The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime is denying that a declaration calling for nations to decriminalize all drug possession and use, which has been circulating at a conference in Malaysia, is an official policy document. The English billionaire Richard Branson released the document to the public earlier today via his blog. The draft declaration was reportedly written by Dr. Monica Begg, chief of the UN Drug Office's section on HIV/AIDS. The document states it, quote, explains that decriminalizing drug use and possession for personal consumption is consistent with international drug control conventions, unquote. It also explains that decriminalization may be required for nations to meet their obligations under international human rights law. The declaration notes that arrest and incarceration can affect access to fundamental rights to health, work, education, housing, and the vote, and also separate parents from children. The denial by UNODC comes as no surprise. Branson claimed in his blog post leaking the document that at least one government was pressuring the agency to withdraw the paper. The agency responded by saying it's not possible to withdraw what's not yet ready.
A cell phone video of a police officer taking down a 15-year-old student in a hallway at his school has gone viral on the internet and sparked protests at the school itself. The incident took place at a high school in Rhode Island last week, following a similar incident the previous week at a high school in Texas. The video shows a police officer approaching the boy from behind and throwing him to the ground, then kneeling on his back. The officer appears to be about twice the size of the boy he tackles. In response, Tolman High School students walked out of school today as an act of protest. They were met by police who pepper sprayed the students and arrested 10. A small group of student protesters and supportive staff members met with the mayor, school superintendent, and director of public safety. They called for an end to the presence of police officers in schools.
The head of an international medical charity, whose hospital in northern Afghanistan was destroyed in a U.S. airstrike, says that there is no way the bombing could have been a mistake. The Doctors Without Borders executive told reporters that the, quote, extensive, quite precise destruction, unquote, of the bombing raid cast doubt on American military assertions that it was a mistake. Meanwhile, The Huffington Post reported Sunday that Senator Bernie Sanders has said he supports President Obama's decision to keep troops in Afghanistan, prolonging the war beyond 2016. Democratic presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton also said Friday that she thought Obama had made the right decision in deciding to keep troops in Afghanistan. Junaid Ahmed with the Center for Global Dialogue in Lahore, Pakistan, disagrees. He said today that President Obama's backpedaling and his decision to remove troops from Afghanistan shows clearly the failure of the so-called war on terrorism. According to Ahmed, the U.S. war and occupation of Afghanistan have only increased violence and instability, not ended or reduced it. Here's a clip of Ahmed speaking on the Real News Network today.
First of all, it wasn't exactly very clear what the objectives were even in the first place. You know, today President Obama again cites, you know, we have to be there to prevent Al-Qaeda from, doing anything harmful there or against America. You know, Al-Qaeda is insignificant there. It was even then, and it is even more so now. And in some ways, this continues to be this incredible bogeyman used to deflect attention away from, you know, real resistance that emerged right away to foreign occupation in Afghanistan. Now, that came largely under the banner of the Taliban, but the Taliban itself became an umbrella group for a whole bunch of various resistance forces in Afghanistan. And of course, now you have the added dimension of a far greater terrorist threat, if you will, and that's in the form of ISIS. So this is a real scandal. Now, there's so many reasons that have emerged to motivate this resistance. It, of course, includes the criminality of the occupation itself, you know, just recently, basically a war crime committed in terms of targeting this Doctors Without Borders hospital. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. Such types of things have happened routinely throughout this more than now a decade and a half of this occupation, all sorts of war crimes, drone attacks, special forces invasions into homes that have humiliated the population. Add to that the puppet regime, you know, first of Hamid Karzai, that was parachuted into Kabul, and the corruption, the arrogance and incompetence of that regime, which simply siphoned off billions of dollars to its cronies and its allied warlords. And all of this, of course, you know, the Afghan population did not take too kindly of. And so that's why so many grievances have emerged that have provided the reservoir of support to any resistance force that has emerged against the occupation and the government in Kabul.
That was Junaid Ahmed with the Center for Global Dialogue in Lahore, Pakistan, speaking on the Real News Network.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel's own party posed an opposition to her open-door refugee policy, having recently launched a parliamentary initiative proposing to build a Berlin Wall-style fence on Germany's borders to keep the refugees out. According to the Bild newspaper, this so-called secret plan was supported by 188 of Ms. Merkel's 310 parliamentary party MPs. So far, Ms. Merkel has rejected all demands for new border fences. Christian von Stetten, the conservative MP leading the initiative, stated that there should be no taboos about taking another look at their border fortifications, and seemed confident that the plan would be voted in within a fortnight. The number of refugees in Germany is expected to reach 1 million this year, and the country is stressing to find ways to handle the influx. Ms. Merkel has won approval from her own party for so-called transit zones at Germany's borders, from where economic migrants from safe countries could be deported back home. The Social Democrat coalition partners and opposition politicians oppose this idea, comparing the proposed zones to concentration camps.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, October 19th, 2015. An elderly woman died of tear gas inhalation, 31 youth injured during ongoing clashes with Israeli soldiers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. An elderly Palestinian woman from Al-Isawiya town in occupied Jerusalem died late on Sunday at night on a military roadblock after Israeli soldiers manning the roadblock on the eastern entrance of the town delayed a car moving her to hospital. Huda Darwish, 65 years of age, suffered a respiratory issue due to tear gas inhalation before her family took her in their car in an attempt to reach a hospital. The family reached the Israeli military roadblock east of the town, where dozens of cars were lined up. The driver tried to bypass the cars, but the soldiers fired several live rounds in the air and forced him to stop. The family pleaded with the soldiers, who saw the elderly woman fading away due to severe effects of tear gas inhalation, but they kept delaying until the woman was near death. The Palestinian Health Ministry has reported Monday that the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli fire since the beginning of this month has arrived to 46, including 10 children, in addition to a political prisoner who died of medical negligence. On Monday, more than 31 youth were injured during ongoing clashes in the West Bank districts of Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Tul Karim, and Qalqilya. Dozens of students suffered Monday the effects of tear gas inhalation in the Palestinian Technical University Khadduri, west of the northern West Bank city of Tul Karim, after Israeli soldiers fired gas bombs into the college campus. Moreover, 17 Palestinians were reported injured when Palestinian youth clashed with invading Israeli soldiers in Qalqilya city center and its southern entrance. Meanwhile, 11 were injured during clashes between invading Israeli troops and youth in the town of Abu Dis near Jerusalem. Two more civilians were injured when Israeli forces attacked protesters in Takua village near Bethlehem city. In other news, dozens of soldiers invaded on Sunday evening and Monday at dawn various towns and neighborhoods in Jerusalem and kidnapped 12 Palestinians, including 4 children, between the ages of 11 and 14. An additional 17 Palestinians, including children, were kidnapped by Israeli troops during invasions in different parts of the occupied West Bank. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the October 19th, 2015 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Callie Mikhail, Don Zur, and Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Callie.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with special guests Abe and Joe. At 9, on Alternative Radio, poet, critic, and columnist Katha Pollitt speaks on the fate of legal abortion. At 10, it's Air Cascadia.